Leadership shouldn't be about who speaks the loudest, but rather who speaks the truest. I'm Charlotte Otter. Welcome to Speech Bubbles, the podcast that's rewriting the rulebook on leadership, communication, and success. In every episode, we're bursting the bubbles of traditional leadership, bringing you raw, real conversations with trailblazers who don't just challenge the status quo, they obliterate it. We're talking to heads of communication who know the power of words, HR mavericks reshaping workplace culture, and leaders from backgrounds that have been silenced for far too long. This is where vulnerability meets strategy, where authenticity beats artifice, where diverse voices don't just speak, they roar. Whether you're climbing the corporate ladder or building your own, Speech Bubbles is your roadmap to leadership that's human, powerful, and unapologetically you. Are you ready to transform how you communicate, lead, and succeed? Then let's burst some bubbles. My guest today is Joanne Lockwood. Joanne is a founder and CEO, a keynote speaker, inclusive culture expert, advisory board member, and podcaster. Her business, See Change Happen, partners with companies to help them become more culturally aware and inclusive. Joanne has personal experience of why inclusion matters. She transitioned in 2016 with the full support of her wife and children and has experienced the world of work both as a man and as a woman. She writes and speaks in the media, on her own podcast, and on international stages on why trans inclusion matters so much, especially now. Joanne says, "One of the most challenging parts of being trans at work is constantly having to explain or justify your existence. By doing your own research, you can help take the burden off those who shouldn't have to educate others just to be respected." Joanne Lockwood, welcome to Speech Bubbles.
Charlotte, thank you so much for the invite and what a warm welcome. And yeah, thank you for that bio and intro.
It's lovely to have you with us, Joanne. So you talk about people doing their own research and educating themselves so that trans colleagues don't have to take on burdens. But we're seeing a shift in the world at the moment, and the burdens that trans women face has increased exponentially lately, including the judgment at the UK Supreme Court that chose to clarify that the word woman means biological sex. Could you unpack this decision a bit and what it means for trans women, their lives and their workplaces?
Yeah, I suppose in simple terms, I listened to the ruling live and watched it unfold. And I think about 5 minutes later, when it sunk in, the word sunk in, I'll be very honest, it hit me. It was brutal. A truth that I had believed for as long as I can remember, certainly throughout my gender transition, was that I would be treated with dignity and respect as a woman, whether I had legal recognition or not. As it happens, I do have legal recognition. I do have something called a gender recognition certificate. I do have that. So I believe that that would give me protection under the law, under the Equality Act in the UK, to live, work, and function as a woman on equal footing in society. That ruling changed that entire understanding for me and for the whole country and the law. And it not only did it say the ruling was from now, the implication was that this ruling was, it was never what you thought it was, even 15, 20 years ago. So it not only stopped it from then, but it wound it back. So it gave justification to the people who said that this has never been the case. You know, you're a trans man or trans woman are not men, not women, and never have been. So it empowered people to weaponize it. But the feeling, and the only way I can describe it, as well as a sense of loss, but it's a complete disenfranchisation. I've lost my agency. I've lost my status, my citizenship, if you like, as a woman. And whilst you may, the obvious things, and we boil it down to toilets and restrooms and changing rooms and women acceleration programs, et cetera, et cetera. We talk about that. But those are minor compared with the disenfranchisation that I feel of no longer being recognised as a woman, as I am, and always believed. And now I've been told that I'm my kind of woman is not good enough. It's not worthy of respect in the same way. Yes, I'm still protected under gender reassignment protections, but that basically what they're saying is they respect me as a trans person, but not as a woman or as a man. I'm in this third space, not man enough, not woman enough, therefore other and in the middle. And I don't see any way out of this at the moment. We look at what's going on in the US. The protections are being pulled back by the administration in the US right now. People being forced out of the military, having their passports revoked, having their driving license revoked, actively a witch hunt going on. I am concerned. And people may accuse me of being overdramatic here, but I'm also a pragmatist and a realist, that this will empower people to become toilet police, to become vigilantes, to want to inspect me wherever I go. And if the employer or service provider hasn't put proper facilities or support in place, where do I go? I am reluctant to push myself into the disabled toilet or the other space. I want a seat at the table where I am one or the other, and that is not male. My seat at the table is female. And the confusion in the UK is that legally, I am a woman. So this gender recognition certificate gives me a new birth certificate. So my birth certificate on it says the word girl and says the word Joanne. So I am legally a woman for all purposes except for the Equality Act. But the Equality Act governs day-to-day employment, service provision. So that's where the confusion arises. I still have the right to privacy. I still have the right to dignity. I still have the right to keep my data and information private. So I'm not obliged to share that with you. So that's putting another complication on service providers now. How do they go, oh, Joanne, you don't look quite woman enough to me. Can I just check your biological sex, please? I go, okay, so how would you like me to prove that? Well, I'd like you to confess that you're not biological enough for us. I'm going to go, what? So you want me to out myself? It's created a really murky area. And I know many people frame this as clarity. And maybe at the high level view from space, it looks like clarity. But once you get into the weeds, it's murky, confusing, and risks being dehumanizing.
I have two things to say. Firstly, I'm really sorry for the way that ruling has made you and others feel. And secondly, when we had a chat last week, you compared the disenfranchisement that you feel with the Windrush generation in the UK. Could you just elaborate a little bit on that comparison?
Yes. So the Windrush, there was back in the, forgive me if my history is not quite correct here, but around the 1950s, 1960s, and maybe even to the early 1970s, the UK government encouraged people to come from the Caribbean area, the Jamaica. We were post-war. We had a people shortage, a men shortage. We need a resource. We need to bolster our workforce and our communities and culture. So we welcomed people from the Caribbean area, and that was all fine for years and years and years and generations. And then suddenly, it transpired that our government managed to shred or lose a lot of these immigration records. So when an audit or something took place, it transpired that many of these people could no longer prove their citizenship or their right to be here. And they not only they, but also their families, their children, their, in some cases children's children, were now deemed to be not British citizens and liable to deportation. And these people here had functioned in this country for all of their adult life, for all of their working life, and now suddenly they're being told that it's not that they're no longer welcome, but they were never welcome in the first place because there's no evidence. And this caused a major concern and a human rights violation that I think is still reverberating today, because I believe that some people were actually deported and there are still cases going on. So that's, and as a bystander to that event, I kind of heard it but I didn't absorb it. I had no lived experience, but now I have this lived experience. I go, wow, that's how it feels to suddenly lose your country. And again, I don't want to sound overdramatic, but that's how it makes me feel.
A kind of excision of citizenship, which is truly brutal. So, Joanne, you're often called on to speak in public about being a trans woman, and I've seen clips of you on GB News, which, for those listeners who are not from the UK, this is a kind of right-wing channel quite similar to Fox News in the US. And I've seen you keeping very calm while people around you are going purple in the face and apoplectic and spouting opinions dressed up as facts. How do you keep so calm?
I don't know. I suppose one of my core values, I suppose, is that we're all entitled to views and opinions. We don't have to be right. We don't have to be wrong. I also know that I'm going in onto that segment, that newscast. I know that they're going to try and provoke me, prod me, poke me, whatever it may be. They're looking for an argument, a reaction. They want to point the finger and go, ha, 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 see, angry trans woman getting upset here and becoming irrational. So my core objective is to always be calm, cool, collected, and almost water off a duck's back. Let anything just flow over the top of me, because I know that's what they want to achieve. They want to prod me. Even if they get an antagonistic guest in that is anti-me, they often do pit me up against somebody else, or the interviewer is deliberately obtuse about a particular topic. I know they're going to do it, so I'm ready. And so I have all my sound bites on post-its around the screen. I've got my core messages I want to play back. And I'm not afraid to push it back to the question asker and say, come on, really? Do you listen to what you just said there? Does that really, are you really saying that? Come on, really? So almost like deflecting it back to give myself thinking time to be able to pause, reflect, stay rooted, take it up from my amygdala back into my prefrontal cortex and just really, really be rational about it. But, and the other secret I have is my mum, and I love her a bit. She's my amazing ally. She's also a GB News watcher and viewer. And I know she often tunes in. And so when I think about how I'm responding, how I'm reacting in that moment, I always imagine I'm educating my mum. And that helps me, keeps me really grounded, that I'm putting it in lay terms. I'm appealing to the later generation, right-wing Daily Mail reading audience. Therefore, they're not going to resonate with some of the trans echo chamber type comments. I'm really trying to put it in basic my mum language. So if I can explain it to my mum, hopefully I can explain it to a GB News guest. So that's kind of what's going on in my head. And you can imagine how I'm juggling it, this cognitive model in my head here. But that's what's going on in my brain as I'm talking. And I'm doing it now. Yeah.
Yeah, well, a couple of things come up for me. One is you could give PR masterclasses, because if that's your intention, that is what you're achieving, just that keeping calm, sticking to the message, thinking about an audience member who is open to you and friendly, pushing it back to the interviewer, not overreacting, complete masterclass. But I want to pick up on something you said there, which was about everybody's entitled to their opinions. Because as I've gone through some of the things you've written and said, that comes up for me a lot, that although you are speaking as a trans woman and sometimes for the trans community, you're aware that people are coming from different opinions and have different attitudes. And you're not necessarily trying to change opinions, but you're saying, respect mine. Would that be a fair analysis?
Yeah, I think the other, let me contextualize it. Whether people believe me or not, I consider myself a woman. And why, as a woman, would I want women to feel threatened, disadvantaged, excluded, challenged by somebody? Yeah. So if I start with that core value, that I, as a woman, want those things as well, and that's all other women want, I can't therefore promote something that causes other people distress and concern. So that there's a real cognitive thing going on there, trying to see myself in two camps. But So when someone is saying to me that they perceive predatory men as the issue or rapists or whatever it may be, I go, and I agree with you. Predatory men are a problem. Where we diverge in that agreement is their definition of me. So they define me as a biological man pretending to be a woman. I describe myself as a trans woman, a woman, legally a woman, who is a woman, and always had that belief within me. So it depends on where you come from. If you come from the other side of the fence, I'm never going to convince you. That's a core value of yours. And no matter what I say, what arguments or debate I put forward, that's never going to change. You're never going to change my view of who I am. So that there comes a point where arguing about who's right and wrong becomes a very pointless exercise, because we're never going to cross that divide. But if I can start having a conversation, what in your lived experience causes you to have this really, really set view? And then hopefully you'll invite me to give you my perspective or why my opinion is based on my reality. Then whilst we may still remain entrenched in our views, I can then start thinking about how I can now incorporate your model of me without being oppressed by it into my psyche as well. And so I'm constantly juggling these thinking about, you know, when I think about inclusion, belonging, and the work I do, it's trying to negotiate between different people's perspectives to try and come up with a solution that allows everyone to thrive, feel safe, psychological safety, all those kind of buzzwords, without somebody else feeling less than or threatened by. So Equality Act and quality legislation shouldn't be about removing stuff from people. It should be about enabling people to succeed and thrive and feel included and belonging without threat. So that's what we're trying to work towards. And if I can understand why someone is anti-me, then at least I can't change that view, but I can hopefully mitigate it, or I can help people who are in the undecided camp, the not hardly, and then we can sit around the table, have a conversation, say, this is a myth busting. Let's talk about the reality. Meet me, have a coffee with me, understand me. You may still go, you're still a bloke. And I go, okay, I get, yeah, that's your view, that's fine. But am I a threat to you? Okay, no, you're not, but others may be. Okay, we can maybe tackle that through the five whys and go down and drill down on that as well. So I think if you look at my website and other stuff I've written, I use this mantra, smile, engage and educate. So I'm a great believer, if you go into a conversation with a smile, you engage, have conversations, and that's where education comes in. And that works both ways. If I want people to engage and listen to me, I have to be prepared to engage and listen to them when sometimes those opinions are really, really tricky to absorb. But I also have to have my own defense mechanisms, my own shields, my own comfort blanket, where I can go, hang on a minute. Yeah, I need to pull myself out of here now. This is not going to, yeah. Whereas GP News interviews, I know they're going to be 5 minutes. I can put my hazmat suit on. I can put my mask and everything on, go in there, come off, throw all that away, disinfect, feel dirty for 5 minutes, go, all right, relax.
Yeah, I felt a heavy emotion in my body as you were talking about the juggling act and that sort of moving between fight or flight and the rational part of your brain. And I really feel that, you know, the heaviness of that, the juggling of that, the emotional labor that you're doing. But on some level, there's a parallel to that with the work that you do with companies. And I'd love to know a little bit more about how you operate, how your business works, and what companies in the UK call on you for in terms of your services.
I would say predominantly, if you ask me I don't know if you have Ron Seal where you come from, the Ron Seal, it does what it says on the tin sort of thing. I'm a professional speaker is how I professionally identify. And my subtext of that is the inclusive culture expert. So I talk about inclusive cultures and helping people in organizations create cultures where people can thrive. And I do that through public speaking, keynotes, stage speaking, lunch and learns, podcasting like this. I also run workshops, education sessions, in person, online. And at the other side is I do consulting, critical friend work, you know, challenging, going onto boards, working out people help develop their own inclusion playbook, their recruitment playbook, their trans inclusion playbook. So I'm helping them to develop a process. The idea being, in all of this, that it's not a one-hit wonder. It's not a turn up, deliver, go, and nothing ever changes. It's always with the three things. We like three things, don't we? So one is act, think, and feel differently. So I want people to act, feel, and think differently as a result of contact with me. So how are we going to move you forward from where we are now through some enlightenment into positive action from it? Otherwise, all we end up doing is just having lots of talk, but nothing changes. So it's making sure there's actionable takeaways, whether that's a keynote, whether that's training, or whether that's a consulting phase.
So we've seen a big shift in the US in terms of diversity. We're seeing diverse language being erased. We're seeing defunding. Are you noticing that same kind of shift in the UK, or is there still a strong commitment to DEI?
I think the tentacles of the US run along, and they weave themselves into many things. And whether they're direct, indirect, or you think there's something fishy going on here, there's definitely involvement. And we see a lot of companies who are, even if they're UK-based, they have US subsidiaries, they're tied into US contracts, or they're one removed from the government and the other company doesn't want to. So this is being pushed down the supply chain. So I'm definitely seeing it. I do wonder whether some of the changes in what's going on with the trans legislation in the UK has been influenced heavily by some people in the US, whether directly or indirectly, as part of government or part of the funding. But I don't think it's true to say we need to throw DEI out the window, diversity, equity, inclusion. Maybe the way that US approached it was maybe more aggressive. Maybe it wasn't open and fair. Maybe they did prioritize certain identity groups higher than maybe white traditional identity groups, male identity groups. Maybe the people who were white, people who were male, felt threatened by those positive action schemes, by those equity platforms that were putting forward. So maybe there was a balance needed to be had. And I'm not apologizing or giving too much opinion there on what went wrong. But I don't believe you can be inclusive by excluding people. And maybe what happened was, inadvertently, people were being disenfranchised themselves from the inclusion efforts. They thought, well, this is not for me. This is for others. Where's my turn as a white man, as a working class white man, as a whatever, or a working class white woman? So I think that there was nothing for some people to identify with. And I think what's going on in the UK, very similar. People are saying, hang on a minute. And then you get labelled with diversity is hiring for second best. There was this thing, I think a helicopter crashed in Hudson Bay, I think it was, or something like that. And they found that the pilot was a woman. Therefore, the crash was because the pilot was a woman or a black woman. Therefore, it proves that hiring for diversity means that you've hired for second best because a white man wouldn't have crashed. QED. So I think there's those kind of beliefs. And so there's a lot of myths about meritocracy. I mean, Elon Musk was a big purporter of meritocracy. But we know there's lots of evidence to say that meritocracy is perspective. And it depends on where you're looking. And it can be fair or unfair. But I think what we have to do is be able to challenge, and I often use the phrase, challenge the BS of meritocracy, because it doesn't always cater for lived experience. And especially when we think about dyslexia, neurodiversity, poor mental health, being a woman, being whatever else it may be, where you don't have access to the same social capital. So I think we've got to call that out. But fundamentally, what was DEI about? And again, if you looked at my website and other things and some of the things I write, I talk about positive people experiences. Isn't that what we're trying to create in our society? A positive experience for all people. And I appreciate you can't do it for everybody, but that could be the strive. So as an organization, when I'm interacting with you as a company, am I feeling positive about you? Do I resonate with your brand? Do I resonate with your marketing? Do I resonate with the product? Did it work for me? How do you treat me when I walk in your door? How do I feel? And if I'm dealing with you as an individual, either as a representative of the company or a representative of self, are you leaving me feeling positive about our conversation? So that, if you say that fundamentally, yeah. Standard branding, standard marketing, standard customer service, all those kind of things. We want to leave a positive experience for people. That's all DEI is. is creating environments
For
where people have a positive experience as an employee, as a candidate, as a stakeholder, as a customer, whatever it may be. That's what we're trying to do. So COVID, we spun on the spot. Well-being was the big issue. Everybody was going through poor mental health. Everybody was confused. Everybody was lost at sea. And we went, yeah, we need well-being. We need to focus on this. And then suddenly COVID's out, get back in the office. Well-being's down the list again. We need to make some money. Let's go out there and make some money again. So I think we've got to go back to some of those values that we learned very quickly in COVID to show that we can care and we can be people-centric and we can think about the positive experience we're trying to create. And if you don't want to call it DEI, don't call it DEI. Just call it fair, equitable solutions that help people survive and thrive without making anyone feel marginalized or excluded by the inclusion.
Yeah, those are lovely insights. I really enjoy meritocracy as a perspective. Meritocracy is not a given. It's not the air that we breathe. Very much a perspective. And also the perspective that we're not tied to the language. We're not obsessed with the words diversity, equity, inclusion. Call it positive people experiences, but just make people feel welcomed in the workplace. So, Joanne, one of my interviewees in We Need New Leaders is Michelle Betancourt, who is a trans woman. And Michelle describes the difference of her experience being CEO of a company as a man. Actually, she was CEO of several companies. And then being a board member as a woman. So two leadership experiences. What have the differences been for you in your experience?
I definitely don't feel part of the club anymore. And that's a really nebulous sort of description of what I just said there. But I went from an environment where I felt included by default, where I was having the conversations, I was leading conversations, I was in with the people making the decisions. And whether it's because I'm trans or whether it's because I'm a woman, it's really hard to narrow the two down because both happened at the same time. But I definitely don't feel as invited as I used to. And that's a really strange feeling because the doors don't seem to open as easily or even have, I'm not even sure where the doors are anymore to some of these things. And I definitely see, I said to you earlier that one of the things I do a lot of is professional stage speaking, keynote speaking. I see colleagues and friends who talk about DEI. I see women talk about female empowerment. I see lots of people doing their own initiatives around this. And I talk a lot about recruitment and other things. And I just perceive that other people are getting more gigs. I know you can't judge by social media, but I just perceive some people seem to be doing a lot better. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute, is it because I'm trans? Is it because I'm a woman? Because some of these people are men? Is it because my marketing, my branding? Is it because I'm just not good enough? And I'd like to think I'm competent and good enough. So where's it going wrong? And I can only put it down to being trans and potentially female in certain areas as well. But I think mainly being trans is the issue. It's still seen as a negative. Certainly not an asset in my brand, unless you're looking for someone like me. If you're looking for someone like me, then I'm an asset. But if you're not looking for someone, you think it may polarize your audience. You may think there's going to be people in the audience go, oh, what do I want to see a trans woman speak for? I'm not without friction, so I get that. And again, something I talk about in often is you can't be all things to all people. And we have a product in the UK called Marmite, which is not dissimilar, I think, to Vegemite in Australia and other places. It's a kind of a yeasty, very strong.
I grew up eating
spread.
Marmite in South Africa. Yeah. Don't you worry. Yeah. I know it.
And yeah, the saying is you either love it or you hate it. And I remember a quote by the broadcaster Chris Evans, who was on Top Gear and Radio 1, Radio 2 DJ. He said, you know, people have to love you or hate you. People have to know what you stand for. If they love you or hate you, it doesn't matter. As long as you stand for something. So I recognize that not everyone's going to like me, and that's fine. I don't like everybody. No one has to like me. So I think you have to stand for something. And if you're too wishy-washy or bendy, then you lose that authenticity. I want to know if you're not happy with the Trump administration, have the kahunas to come out and say so. Don't just sit on the fence and go, oh, if I say something, it might turn off my bookings or I got a living to earn. Well, that's fine. That's your business model. That's fine. But I guess I'm in the space where I can't just put my identity on a shelf and compromise it. I have to be me. And I polarize people by existing. So that I have no choice in that, I'm afraid. And I'm not, I was going to say privileged enough. I'm not sure if it's a privilege. I'm not able to blend in seamlessly with my voice, my mannerisms, my visual appearance, my hair, all those other things. So I'm not able to look like your bell curve of normality, stereotypical woman. So I get that. And I am who I am. But I'm prepared to look you in the eye and challenge your perspective on that as well.
Yeah, that's quite a story from being part of the default to then being a person who challenges others merely by existing. You know, that's a kind of, you know, transition is physical, but it's also psychological, isn't it? And spiritual. It's quite a massive transition that you've been through.
And then you layer on the recent Supreme Court ruling and what Trump's doing. I'd already decided back in probably February that I was never going to, well, I wouldn't be able to go back to the US and any gigs out there for the foreseeable. I've already accepted I couldn't go to the Middle East. I can't go to Malaysia or any country like that anymore because most of them have anti-gay laws and those apply to trans people as well. So I'd already decided that the world was a lot smaller for me anyway. So that the US was now smaller. Now I'm realizing my country is now, I'm now being boxed into it sort of thing. So I'm even more marginalized than I was already. But there's also the impact on my family. You said right at the beginning that my family are supportive. I'll be really honest that it took them a while to become supportive and embrace me. They had to adjust their model of who I was in their heads and their acceptance. But my existence impacts them. I know my daughter has experienced unwanted inquiries in her workplace as a result of me asking her views on me. I don't know if it's a report or someone, they obviously tracked her down. So I'm very conscious now of identifying her, which is why I haven't used her name here. She even encourages me not to use the fact I've got a daughter. My wife also feels very exposed. You know, we're two women, we're married. Our marriage license says wife, with my birth certificate saying girl. So my wife is impacted as well by the politics, by the decisions, by my ability to work and our ability to go together. Because we do work together. We run a business together. So we are inextricably linked emotionally, romantically and financially. So yeah, it's beyond that. And my friends and the people who know me, they can be put in an awkward position where they have to pick a side sometimes because, again, the debate is so polarizing.
And with all those personal intricacies in mind and also given the nature of your business, how do you think about your reputation?
One thing I said to during my transition was in order to be liked, you have to be likable. In order to be loved, you have to be lovable. In order to be worthy of respect, you have to earn that. And the values I've already talked about here are things I hold quite dear to me, the core values. I don't catfish people. When you meet me, it's me. I call people out or call people in. I educate wherever I can. And I step out of spaces where I feel that I can't either educate or I don't feel safe. So I do live my mantras, and it annoys my wife sometimes because she'll be having a rant about something and I'll sit there and give the other side and give another perspective. Will you just support my opinion for once? Well, I don't not support you, but what I'm trying to do here is give another opinion or another perspective on that to help you find acceptance in that view, not trying to persuade you're wrong. And I can't help myself sometimes, which is why it gets quite tricky where, I'm with old friends who know me for 40 odd years. They have quite different views to me about a number of things. Probably more GB news readers and Daily Mail readers. And I find it hard to be amongst certain people now where I know their views are polarized because it probably means they're still confused about me as well. So I do step out of those spaces, but yeah, it's, I think it's easy to be one person. And one of the reasons One of the things I look back on my gender transition was I went from a noisy brain with all these different voices in my head and all this stuff going on, dividing my brain into multiple parts and having different conversations and who do I tell this and who do I tell that to, and almost like juggling all these truths in my head. And it not just my gender identity, but also my business and other things. I was juggling lots of truths or perspectives. I think one of the things I got from gender transitioning was I was no longer ashamed of who I was. So that I was no longer lying about who I was. And I think once you've told your biggest truth, then there's no reason to lie or hide other things. So I don't feel I have to hold stuff in my head anymore. So my mind is very clear. I can think and speak authentically whilst holding multiple perspectives in my hands, looking at them and going, how do I rationalize this and build my own model around that without feeling that I'm compromising myself? I feel very authentic in that. So yeah, it's the gender transition really has simplified my model of the world and brought into context around social constructs, how we as a species have designed the world we live in, and we as a species can renegotiate that and evolve it and change it. We're not wedded to the 1 + 1 = 2. It's not. We can make a new sum up. We can explore things. We can be Darwinian and evolve.
We certainly can evolve. And, I have two daughters and a son, and my son was my third child. And when he was born, people kept saying to me, "What's the difference between having daughters? Now you have a son." And I was like, "He's just a little baby human." People wanted me to tap into the social construct. They wanted me to describe attributes that are considered typical of a male. And I just saw a gorgeous little baby human, and I experienced that as quite a pressure, which was to sort of name masculine attributes in order to make people around me feel comfortable. But that is just an aside. You were talking about aspects of your reputation around you're very driven by your values, you have empathy for others, and you have the you feel that you now have the freedom to be authentic. And that came up a lot for me while I was writing New Leaders. So I interviewed established leaders from underrepresented minorities and from different backgrounds and identities and emerging leaders. And almost all of them described having been through obstacles in their life to get where they were, whatever those obstacles were, whether it was because they were neurodiverse, because they were women in tech, because they were LGBTQIA. But those obstacles gave people empathy for others, wherever those others were coming from, whatever political angle they were coming from, and also a sense of, I know who I am, I know what my issues have been, I've worked them through, this is who I am now, these are my values, and I act accordingly. And what emerges from that, from a reputation point of view, is these are people who've done the work. And their reputations are essentially, unless they act suddenly very out of character, their reputations are in effect intact.
Yeah, I'm a great believer in putting a hand up and just saying, I got it wrong. Probably, I've been through, I'm 60 years old. I've been through a lot of life. I've got a lot of things wrong. Starting when I was probably 16 or 17, I made some big bad decisions. And throughout my 20s, again, I made some bad decisions, error judgment, where I had to hone my model down of right and wrong, ethical, unethical. I think I went through a lot of things in my life where I was called to task for things I got wrong. And I guess I learned from them. The only mistake is one you never learn from, I guess. Nobody died. Nothing went badly wrong, but it was fairly inconvenient, a number of these things. And I still learn. I've made a mis- I chaired a board until recently, and some things went wrong, and I had to step down. And I'm not saying, and I just pragmatically said to everybody, I said, look, you're right, I could have done better. I could have done better. I'm not going to hide that. Show me someone who would have done better or different, that's fine. But I did what I believed, and I'm prepared to sit here and answer all your questions honestly and truthfully, with nothing to hide, because I believe I did my best. And if you say I should have done this, but I'd probably say you're right, because we wouldn't be in the mess had I done it right, had I done that. But I was playing whack-a-mole with all this stuff over here as well, and that didn't go wrong. So, you know what it's like? You always get caught for the one thing you didn't do rather than the 50 things you did do. So, and yeah, I still learn, and I still want to learn, still want to grow. And I don't beat myself up too much. You know, I'll have a pity party. I'll lay awake at night replaying that scenario time and time again, trying to solve the equation, thinking, could I have done this? Could I have done that? And I get to a point and go, I found acceptance. I could have done differently. You could argue I should have done differently. I'm not going to disagree with you. But we are where we are. What would I do differently next time is the lesson I need to learn from this.
Yes. And when you describe that to me, what comes up is I learned through my research that there's something called single loop and double loop learners. So single loop learners see a problem, fix, often blame others. Double loop learners see a problem, fix, and ask the question, what role did I play in this problem and what could I do better next time? Which is really interesting. So, Joanne, my mission, both with this podcast and with We Need New Leaders, is to address and try to change the very old school archetype we have in our brains of what a leader looks like. Loud, overconfident, often men, not always, but a particular mental archetype that we have. What do you think we can do, both as individuals and collectively, to change that archetype and start to embrace new ways of leading?
I've actually looked at different leadership models and tried to identify myself in there. And I think the best leaders flip between different models, and they have different personas within their leadership. And that's still authentic, but it's recognizing you need to be different at different times. I think if I was to categorize my leading style, it's probably transformational. So I like to throw something at the wall, a big picture. I like to get everyone around that picture and point it and go, wouldn't that be fantastic? Wouldn't that be amazing? If we get something like that, that's where we want to be, don't we? And everyone goes, that's exactly where we want to be. And then we can work back. If that's where we want to be, how do we use a coaching model? Well, that's 10. What does 5 look like? What does 2 look like? How do we get to 3? So that's kind of my natural kind of mentor, coachy, transformational leadership sort of style. But also I'm one of these, I can't stop myself rolling my sleeves up, diving in there and saying, okay, come on, I'll be in this with you. Or if there's a vacuum, I'll dive in and fill the vacuum and say, look, come on, let's get the train out of the station. Come on, let's make things happen right now. Run with it. Which sometimes I go too far. Sometimes the train's too far at the station. Everyone's left on the platform and I haven't brought them with me. So that's, and I think it depends on the horses for courses. If you've got a very tight governance, you need to have more of an old school leadership where you are enforcing quality and standards and process and procedures and micromanaging and checking and balancing. Whereas I work better with people I think who are artisans, self-starting, people who want to be transformed rather than managed. And I think, so what do we need to do? I think we need to be adaptive as leaders. We need to look at our audience. When we take over a new team, we need to sit around a table and go, let's all self-declare. How do you like to work? This is my style. What's your style? And then when we see conflicts in our styles, then we can sit down and have a cup of coffee and say, look, I feel some friction here. It's not working. And sometimes the person who is senior has to take responsibility for that, but also as a team member, I can take responsibility and coach my leader as well. So we all have to lead self and advocate. So I think this early dialogue and continual dialogue between leader and team, leader and stakeholder, no one has to be right. That's the key thing. You've got to be right. You've got to be curious. You've got to embark on this journey and course correct without it being a fixed destination. And I'm a great believer in vector and velocity. It's not about targets and quotas, and it's about where do we want to head on the horizon? How quick are we going? And do we need to course correct, slow down, speed up, whatever it may be? Because we've got to make sure that people are still with us. And there's another thing I picked up over the years. I think it's an army saying, you always have to, with change programs or whatever you do, you have to go at the pace of the slowest person. I remember My wife isn't as fit as me, and we were walking up a mountain or a hill or something. And what happened was I'd go up to this, I'd find a rock and sit on it, and my wife would catch up. And as soon as she'd catch up, I'd go off again. And it dawned on me that my wife was never getting a rest. So what I needed to do was rest at that rock for her to have a rest. And I think when we're doing change management, when we're a leader, we need to rest for the slowest person so that everybody doesn't get change fatigue, they don't get project fatigue, whatever it is, the conflicting priorities kick in. Hang out on that rock. How are we doing? Can we make, can we make the next rock? Or do we need to sit here a bit longer? Or do we need to find a different rock? Because that one's too high. We want to get. I think as a leader, keeping your eyes and ears open and making sure we're listening all the way through that journey. And we're not just setting off into the sunset with our sunk cost bias and we've just got to make it happen. And I've got to deliver this project by Friday. Regardless, sometimes you just need to stop. Whoa, hang on a minute. Facts have changed. Priorities have changed. Let's review. And then your team will thank you for that as well. They'll then see that you're listening to them and that you care about you. And you, because I think that two-way trust is important as well in leadership.
So what I'm hearing, Joanne, is be curious, be adaptive, and make sure to listen to your team and go at the pace of your slowest member. Now we're going to our three standard questions that I always ask. Give us a book recommendation.
So I listen to a number of Audible books and I read articles on my phone. So I read a lot of stuff on my phone, mainly web pages or blogs, things like that, which is why I consume a lot of my stuff. But if I imagine that I read these books, but I listened to them, and this is Rutger Bregman, you may have heard. He's written two books that I know of. One is Utopia for Realists, which is the first one I read of his. And then the second one was Humankind. And as I'm reading them, my model of reality either absorbed what he wrote or I lent into his model. And somehow we became very entwined in our thinking about humanity and what makes a good life a good person. And so if you've never read those two books, Utopia for Realists is fantastic. And you know, think about universal basic income, think about the value of money, those kind of things. That really does to shine light on humankind. Talk about war and conflict and carpet bombing and human spirit and the human, the homo papi, I think he called it, how we as a species like to be liked. And we all get up in the morning wanting to be a good person, wanting to do a good job. And often we assume the worst in people when really people want, are the best of themselves. They just stub their toe on something and it makes them go the other way. So believe in the human spirit, believe in the kindness of humanity.
Well, those that are two that are definitely on my reading list for sure. I really would. I follow him on Instagram, so it's definitely time to start buying his books. You know, my mission, as I said, is change the leadership archetype, but it's also to inspire our emerging leaders who want to land, keep, or create their dream leadership roles. What three tips do you have for emerging leaders from diverse backgrounds or underrepresented minorities?
I think it's fair to say there's no free lunch. I think that's the key thing. I've heard people criticize about tokenization. I would reframe it and think, well, if you're going to tokenize me, let me make it, let me use it. Let me go into it eyes wide open and say, and challenge and say, look, I know you're tokenizing me. I know you've put me in here for a reason. Will you back me? Do I have your full support? If I do, then use that position because if you don't take it, either a traditional person will, or another marginalized person will be tokenized. So I think take the opportunity, but do it eyes wide open and make it part of your ask that I know you've done it. How are you going to support me? How are you going to make sure I can succeed in this role? I think that's one. Start with the end in mind. Where possible, I try and I often say make decisions with hindsight. I guess that's the definition of foresight, isn't it? But what do you wish you'd done? And start with a ton of questions to challenge. I do a lot of deep thinking about scenarios. So I run a lot of, again, I've no idea if everyone does this, but I run simulations in my head and permutations about how to play things out. So I do that a lot. So I try and work back from the best case and then work out what I have to negotiate, what's going to go wrong. It's like if you send an email, I always think, how's the person going to reply to me? So if there's venom in it, if there's disagreement in it, if there's a challenge in it, am I scared to open their reply? If I'm going to be scared to open their reply, I shouldn't send it. So start with the end in mind. I want to be able to reply to, I want to be able to read the reply with warmth in the way I intended it, unless I'm angry, obviously. And then I want people to feel that. But no, generally, start the end in mind. I think, what, thirdly, be authentic, have courage, you know what you stand for. And recognize when this place isn't for you. And be brave enough to say, it's not for me, I'm out. It's fine. It's okay, I'm out. You don't have to break me. I'm going to go. I can find someone who look after me. So I think those all three probably tie together in some way. But yeah, that's kind of, I suppose, my three. Yeah, I would say those are the three things I live by.
I love that, Joanne. Thank you. So it's eyes wide open, start with the end in mind, and be authentic and courageous.
Yeah, courageous, be prepared to walk away. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. What brings you joy?
At this time in my life, I've been through a life of gluttony. Yeah, like we all have. We leave school, get on our career ladder, we want money, we want a house, we want family, we want stuff, bigger car, bigger telly. And I think what happened was I realized that I now want sufficiency. I've moved my bottle from gluttony to sufficiency. I want freedom of choice, and I need sufficient to grant me that freedom. And that means different things to different people. But I've got a roof over my head, I want food on the table, I want to be able to predict that I'm comfortable to the end of my life. And my family are as well. I want to be surrounded by people who I love and who love me, who give me respect and I respect them. And my income is sufficient to support that life without it being gluttonous. So I think sufficiency is the word I'm looking for there.
Lovely. What a beautiful answer. Joanne Lockwood, thank you for joining me on Speech Bubbles.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.